Hello, everyone. This is Atrevida and Conversations on a Tightrope. We'll be airing part two of Healthcare, the Single Payer System. I'm here again with my guest co-host, Devin McConnell.
Hello.
He just gives me so much confidence. I'm so glad that he could show up. It's wonderful, Devin. Thank you. At 9:30 p.m., I will call Dr. Margaret Flowers, who represents PNHP, which is Physicians for a National Health Program. And I would like to give you a quick background on this group, after which I will play three audios of Dr. Flowers, three interviews before I call her. So here go. Let me tell you a few things. And remember, if you would like to give me any feedback, it's atrevida45@verizon.net or feedback@wgxc.org or info@wgxc.org, or you can call 518-828-0290. Now, Physicians for a National Health Program is a single-issue organization advocating a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health program. And it has more than 18,000 members and chapters across the United States. Since 87, they've advocated for reform in the U.S. healthcare system. They educate physicians and other health professionals about the benefits of a single-payer system, including fewer administrative costs and affording health assurance for the 50.7 million Americans who have none. Our members and physician activists work toward a single-payer national health program in their communities. PNHP is the only national physician organization in the U.S. dedicated exclusively to implementing a single-payer national health program. Their mission is, they believe, number one, that access to high-quality health care is a right of all people and should be provided equitably as a public service rather than bought and sold as a commodity. The mission is also to educate physicians, other health workers, and the general public on the need for a comprehensive, high-quality, publicly funded health care program, equitably accessible to all residents of the U.S. PNHP views this campaign as part of the campaign for social justice in the United States. It opposes for-profit control and especially corporate control of the health system, and favors democratic control, public administration, and single-payer financing. It believes that this program should be financed by truly progressive taxation. It actively opposes current changes in the healthcare system that are designed to maximize the profits of investors and the incomes of high-level executives rather than to serve patients. Its goal is the restoration of what it views as the primary mission of physicians, acting as professional advocates for their patients. It's independent, nonpartisan, voluntary organization, and its work is supported by their members' dues and contributions, by grants from progressive foundations. It accepts no funding from pharmaceutical companies or other for-profit entities. It organizes physicians, medical students, other health workers, and the public in support of this program and promotes discussion of health policy in the U.S. through conferences, lectures, articles, and other methods. Margaret Flowers is a Maryland pediatrician with experience as a hospitalist at a rural hospital and in private practice. She is currently working on single-payer health care full-time. In addition to her activity as co-chair of the Maryland Chapter and Congressional Fellow for PNHP, Dr. Flowers is on the board of Healthcare Now and on the steering committee of the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare. Dr. Flowers obtained her medical degree from the University of Maryland School of Medicine and did her residency at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. I would like to play the first audio. It was at a national protest in June of 2008, and it was held in 19 cities across the country, and the activists in Baltimore City participated in the action. They mounted a picket at the corners of Lombard and Charles Street in the downtown area where Care First, Blue Cross, Blue Shield has an office, And this is, they were supporting H.R. 676, also known as the U.S. National Health Insurance Act. So let me play you this 3-minute clip, and you'll get to know more about Dr. Flowers. Now, one moment, so sorry, I have to do this again because I had it on mute.
Sorry. I'm with Maryland Physicians for National Health Program and also Maryland Universal Healthcare Action Network.
And Margaret, why are you here tonight protesting? What is it you're protesting? What is it you want?
Well, what we want is to get the waste out of our medical system so that we can actually provide health care to all of our peoples. Right now, we spend 25 to 31% of our health care dollars on administrative costs, and that includes helping CEOs have outrageous profits and salaries. And while we have that on one side, on the other side, we have millions and millions of people who are suffering. We have people without insurance who can't get any health care, and then we have people with insurance who still can't get the health care they need. And they're going bankrupt because of that.
Well, Margaret, I heard Ralph Nader say one night that there were 3,000 people that were killed in the World Trade Center, and that 6 times that amount die each year because they don't have health insurance.
That was from a study back in 2002. More recently, the study has shown that we have 101,000 preventable deaths a year in the United States because of our lack of a health care system.
What can the people in the state here of Maryland do, either statewide or federally? What's the remedy for all this?
Well, the remedy is something that's used in all the other industrialized countries around the world. It's been in place for many decades, and it works very well. And it's a system where all of the healthcare dollars go into a single fund. This is called a single payer. And then from that, those dollars are used to pay for all medically necessary care for all the people in the country. And if we did this single pool idea, we actually pay now 2 to 3 times more per person than other countries pay for their to give health care to everybody. So if we actually streamlined our system with the single funding, we could care for everybody in this country and give them all the medically necessary care that they need.
Where can the people go to get more information about this? Is there someplace online they can go?
Yeah, there's plenty of places. You can go to the National Physicians for a National Health Program site, which is www.pnhp.org. In Maryland, you can go to our Maryland Universal Healthcare Action Network site, which is mdsinglepayer.org. There are other sites. Healthcare Now is another good site on the internet.
Okay, well, thanks so much. Anything else, Margaret?
I just want to say that we have the dollars and we have the technology, and there's no reason why right now the United States needs to be ranked 37th in the world for quality of health care and 54th for fairness. We're behind every other industrialized nation, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay, so Devin, she talked there. I found that very incredible when she said at that interview that we rank 37th in the world for quality health care, mm-hmm. and rank 54th for fairness. So, I mean, we certainly have to do better than that.
Yes. I don't know what else to say about that, but yeah, we do.
So there's a lot to learn, and the second interview is very interesting. It's longer, and in it, this was in Washington, D.C. at the Dirksen Senate Building. She was one of 23 people testifying and one of 10 to 12 people at the table. And she mentions that she sat next to Ron Williams, the CEO of Aetna, who makes $28 million with around $38 million in stock options. And she emphasizes that she really was the only one who believes health care is a right, which is very sad. And there she mentions Senator Harkin and Sherrod Brown. And it's an interesting fact about the AMA, which she says it only reflects 30% of physicians nationwide and is more sympathetic to the corporate interests. So let's see what else she has to say. And this is going to be, hold on 1 second, this time I hope I do it better than the last time. And here we go.
Your name?
Dr. Margaret Flowers.
And your professional position?
I am a pediatrician who's currently not practicing. I'm co-chair of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program and on the steering committee of the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare.
Okay. Now, you just testified before Senator Kennedy's committee on single payer. You were one of 23 people who will testify in this hearing. You're the only single payer advocate. Last month, you were arrested by Senator Baucus. So which do you prefer, being arrested or testifying?
I definitely prefer testifying. It's a little more comfortable. But the most important thing, and this is why we were protesting the last time, is that we need to have a seat at the table and have our voice not only heard, but recorded, written in the record, so that we can, you know, have our say and people will see that it's there.
So give me your sense of how it went today. You were one of 10 or 12 people at the table, and so it went on for 3 hours.
Right.
What kind of impact did you have?
Well, I actually have to say I'm very appreciative that some of the senators welcomed me there, and Senator Dodd, I thought, felt was very fair. I was somewhat concerned that being the lone single-payer advocate that they would try to marginalize me and not allow me to speak, but they did allow me to speak. It was an interesting hearing because I was seated next to Ron Williams, who's the CEO of Aetna, who makes $28 million a year, not counting his 30-so million stock options. And so, of course, he and I definitely disagreed over, you know, how healthcare should be paid for. But, you know, they gave me a chance to speak, and I think it's a beginning.
How many single-payer supporters are there in the Senate?
Great question. Well, Senator Sanders and Senator Harkin, we could possibly say that Senator Brown is a supporter. There have been people who have said they support it in meetings, but won't actually sign on to the bill because they don't think it would get the votes. Senator Kennedy has been a single-payer supporter in the past.
Right, but in terms of, okay, so but only...
Only one has co-sponsored. Well, no one's co-sponsored, only one bill.
Only one bill. And so why, for example, do you think, what did Senator Harkin tell you today about single-payer?
Well, he said it to my colleague who was there because Senator Harkin left early and basically said that he used to sell insurance and he understood that the more pools you have, the more it costs, and that, you know, 1,300 pools is very expensive, but one pool is affordable, and so he said single payer is the way to go.
Okay, and so I guess the follow-up for Senator Harkin is, why aren't you signed on?
Right.
Why isn't Sherrod Brown signed on? He also talked to you about signing on?
Oh, he sent me a note about, you know, support, and I haven't spoken to him, you know, personally. I think he would definitely be another person that his constituents should go and speak to.
So is single payer on the table in the Senate now?
You know, I don't know if you saw the C-SPAN footage. I was at the end of the table. I didn't really have much of the table. So I think that's very symbolic of where we are. We're just starting to be at the table, but it's going to take a lot more pushing, a lot more grassroots movement, a lot more pressuring the senators before we actually have a full seat at the table.
Now, polls show that the majority of doctors favor single payer now. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. But
right.
The AMA today came out and said it doesn't support single payer, doesn't even support a public option. How can that be if the majority of doctors support it?
Well, the AMA is only, their membership only reflects about 30% of physicians nationwide, so they're not the majority of physicians. And I view them as being a more corporate, conservative type of body. To me, there were four physicians at that table today. One was from the Enterprise, American Enterprise, one was from Harvard, and then the one from the AMA, and myself. And I have the feeling that of the four physicians at the table today, I was the only one that believes that healthcare is a human right, and that's very disappointing. It's not reflective of most physicians.
Well, and the panel was not reflective of American public opinion.
Right.
What about President Obama? He said in 2003 he supported single payer. All we had to do was take the White House, the House, and the Senate. What are your thoughts on President Obama?
I'm disappointed. You know, people are really looking for a change. This is such an opportunity right now to do the right thing, and I worked hard for his campaign believing that he was going to be a leader and that he would come through for the people. And so I think my optimistic side believes that he still does understand that healthcare is a human right and single payer is the solution, and we need to push him and to give him the political cover through our grassroots movement so he can go in that direction.
So one last thing. Is today the last day that single payer will be heard in the U.S. Senate, or do you think that in the coming hearings, single payer will have a place at the table?
We're going to continue to push for presence at every hearing. I think that's the least that they can do. We've also, and I said it in my opening testimony, are asking for a full hearing on the merits of single payer in the Senate. If they actually want to have an open debate, an open discussion about what's best for this country in healthcare reform, we deserve at least one full hearing to discuss the merits of it. And we've also asked for scoring through the Congressional Budget Office of single payer.
Okay, so you raised scoring. I have to ask you, what would it show? What do you think it will show?
Well, we already have past studies, two by the Congressional Budget Office and one by the General Accounting Office, which showed that single payer saves money, that if we used our health care dollars right now that we're currently spending on a single payer system, we could provide health care to everybody. But not only that, we have numerous studies at the state level done by very reputable organizations, the Lewin Group and Mathematica. They consistently show that single payer saves money. And then if you look at other nations and look at what they spend to cover all of their people, you know, it's just very consistent. Single payer is the only solution for healthcare reform in this country that will actually save money. And it's the most fiscally responsible. Not only that, it's the only universal one. It includes everybody, and it allows doctors and other healthcare providers to practice their profession again without interference from profit-making private insurers.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers.
Thank you.
Okay, so what I have to say from that interview, Devin, in defense of President Obama, he did say if they could take the White House and the Congress. I mean, he really didn't have all the power that he needed when he won. Many of those Democrats were from red states, so they were really reds with a blue D in front of them. And, of course, the Congress, you can see with the trouble. So he knew ahead of time that he was in for a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I'm actually partial to that opinion. This is when I started getting involved was during the middle of the healthcare debate. So I remember pretty much all the fine points in it. And an outright expansion, an outright takeover of single payer would not have been possible.
That's right.
They had a majority of about 55 real Democrats. When it came down to passing, say, the reconciliation bill and some of the other more progressive parts of that bill, you had about 55 Democrats on board. And then you have the other ones like, Lieberman, obviously, Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu, who was that lost in Arkansas, that one woman they primaried. A bunch of not even blue dogs, just conservative Democrats. They were kind of useless. They were corralled into the bill that was passed through all those shenanigans that then got stripped back out. But really, yes, there was only about a majority of 55. However, constitutionally, 51 is the majority. And if our Senate properly reflected maybe the will of the people rather than the way it was set up to reflect the states and the minority, maybe we would have had something more, but that's the way the system works mm-hmm. right now.
He came in, but with a very difficult job.
He did this in what's now referred to as the Obama way. He comes in starting at the middle and then flanking the left pole of the debate in the middle, and then he wants to meet the right in the middle of that. You have the right staying all the way to their side. He starts in the middle, and then they meet somewhere in between those two points.
Yeah.
He never stakes anything out to the left.
Well, I suppose he just was looking at the, you know, what was in the future
He's a pragmatist from the start.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
When I argue with people who argue for him to have been more aggressive, I can't disagree that he should have said, you know, we'll do single payer for, you know, we'll make Medicare for everybody, and then maybe that'll fall on its face, and they'll go, okay, we'll compromise like they're doing right now. You know, if you stake out to the left, you'll at least fall far. The compromise will be further to the left than it would have been if you start in the middle. If he'd said, oh, Medicare for everybody, and then that completely lost and got voted down in the Senate, well, then maybe you'd compromise it down to, okay, this private amalgam bill with maybe a public option. You can't really say what would have happened. You can't predict the past.
Yes, and with all of the emergencies that came up in between everything
right.
that was going on, it's really difficult. It's been a very difficult
It was enough
time
of a complicated balancing act the way it was done.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
but
functionally, he had 60 votes. If he could beat them to death and make them actually. If he was a Lyndon Johnson, if he was a Lyndon Johnson instead of a Bill Clinton kind of president, he might have been able to make that happen.
Well, let's see what.
And Lyndon Johnson did start Medicare, by the way, so maybe.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. So let's see what Margaret Flowers says in this clip. It's in Albany, and it's a little bit longer. So, but she says a whole lot of good stuff, including talking about a movement. So let me.
In this country, you know, people often go around saying that we have the best care. But really, while we do have some good, excellent centers of health care, they're only available to those who can afford them or those who live in proximity to them. And that's part of a market-based model of paying for health care. We find that rich people come from abroad to this country to get health care, while our people are struggling and find themselves going to places like Mexico to get surgery or to Canada, or people that I know who have left the country, gotten sick, and now they can't return because they won't be able to get health care now that they have a pre-existing condition. They're cared for abroad, but they can't come home to their families. We know that in 2009, we had 2.7 million fewer people enrolled in private health insurance, but despite that, the private health insurance corporations had excessive profits, had an increase in their profits during that same period. You know, this is the situation that we're in right now. And what sets us apart from the other industrialized nations is that we use a market-based model of paying for health care, that we don't see health care as a human right, the principles of human rights being universality, equity, and accountability. We have none of those. And we don't have a system. We don't actually have a coordination of our care so that we make decisions on a rational basis of what our population needs. I wanted to comment a little bit about the Deficit Reduction Commission. Have you guys heard of the National Commission for Fiscal Responsibility and Reform? So this new commission of 18 members that was convened in April of this year is looking at ways to reduce our deficit. And one of the ways that they're going about that is looking at cutting our social insurance programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And I just wanted to comment on that because the reality is that healthcare is a huge drag on our economy. Our healthcare costs are rising 2.5% faster than our GDP each year. So it's not a sustainable course that we're on. If we actually brought our healthcare costs in line with what other countries are spending, we would have a budget surplus right now. So healthcare is certainly a driver of our problems economically, but cutting our social insurance programs is actually going to do more harm than good, because we know that programs like Medicare have reduced poverty, that they bring down health disparities. Our population's health disparities start to decline after they reach the age of 65, and that requiring more people to pay personally for their health care by extending, you know, increasing the age of being able to be eligible for Medicare, things like that, is actually going to cause those people to face the same difficulties that much of our population faces of not being able to afford the care that they can get. So Medicare and Medicaid are not the causes of our deficit or our health care cost crisis. They're actually the victims of our healthcare cost crisis. And so we see this solution, which we've been, PNHP has now been around since 1986 or 87, as a national improved Medicare for all, our national single payer, creating a national universal system, publicly funded so that it's accountable, with a progressive taxation so that it's fair, so that it's lifelong, it's comprehensive, no co-pays or deductibles, so that when you're sick and you need to go get care, you're not facing any barriers to getting that care. You're not worried about, well, my rent's due this month, so I can't really pay that co-pay or that deductible for that medication or that test or that visit. It's about creating a system, a rational, publicly accountable, publicly funded system. So what happened during this last process, this health reform process that we had? Very disappointing. At a time in our country when we see such suffering and death and really had a need for an open and honest debate about what we required for health in this nation, we saw instead a very strictly controlled scripted debate that was heavily influenced by the insurance corporations spending $1.4 million a day on lobbyists in Washington, D.C. The legislation in the Senate Finance Committee was overseen by a former Vice President of Public Policy of WellPoint, one of the largest insurers in this country. She has now been transferred by the White House to the Department of Health and Human Services to oversee how this legislation is regulated. So it couldn't be any more blatant. And this is what we're up against. And so how are we going to change that? Well, there are three principles that became very clear, and I know that others have discovered these prior to me. I'm not unique. But they fall under the initials ICU. And I think that's apropos because we're in a healthcare crisis and we need intensive care. So the I stands for independence, and that means that we must create a movement that is independent of political party. The C stands for clarity. It's imperative that we understand what it is that we require in this country and that we're very clear about what that is, because what we see instead is so often, you know, this legislation is being called affordable, it's being called guaranteed. It's none of these things. So we have to be clear on what those words mean, and we need to be uncompromising in our demands. Too often in this nation, we're willing to accept small change, and that's what we've been doing now for decades. And none of those small changes, as we try to patch together the healthcare in this country, none of those changes have moved us forward. And so we have to realize that and stop compromising on in being told that this is all we can get and saying that that's acceptable. So I see you. And I just wanted to wrap up with a comment about that movement, because it does need to be a broad-based movement. It does need to link together the various movements for peace and social and economic justice, because it is all related. And too often in this country, we've been divided. You know, we have this whole right-left raging at each other, and the mainstream media feeds that division. And that's used to weaken us as a people. If you actually talk to people across the board of what their political belief is, we share so many common beliefs. People do believe, you know, that if someone in their family gets sick, that they should get health care. People do, if you take the time to explain it, start to understand the fact that creating a single fund for health care is the most financially efficient way to pay for healthcare. So there are ways that we can bridge that right-left divide, and it's very important that we do that and that we come together and join our forces together to work for social and economic justice. And just wanted to close with something that guides me is the principle of nonviolence, because Martin Luther King said that to witness an injustice and to ignore it, to do nothing about it, is committing an act of violence in itself. And so it's imperative that we continue to do this work. As Kathy Kelly, I don't know if you heard her yesterday, say so clearly, you know, that the seriousness of the situation compels us to do what we can to make these changes.
All right. So that was the last clip, and I'm going to play a little tune, and while that's on, I'm going to try to connect with do that.
The last time I saw a doctor was in 1987, so I went to have a checkup, even though I felt fine. So glad that I had insurance and kept up with all the payments. The nurse said, please have a seat, and 3 hours went by. The doctor seemed like a kindly old man, but what was he doing with that glove on his hand? And where he stuck his finger, I do not wish to mention. He said that I need a CAT scan and a full MRI. Then he stuck me with a big needle and ordered a bunch of blood tests. They called me with the results and I let out a sigh. The news made me very happy. They told me that I was healthy. But then I got a letter from my HMO. Dear customer, your claim is denied. On your application, we found out you lied. You didn't tell us about the measles that you had way back in grade school. And that is a pre-existing condition. Ha ha! Look in the fine print and clearly you'll see. We don't have to pay you one single penny. And now I'm going bankrupt, cause I went to get a checkup to find out that there was nothing the matter with me.
Hello, everyone. I believe I have Margaret Flowers on the phone. Dr. Flowers?
Hello.
Oh, can I hold on a second? Do you hear me?
Yes.
Gee, it's kind of low. I don't know why it's this low, but I hope somehow. Can you hear her?
I can hear you fine.
Can you hear me fine? Can you hear her?
Very, very, very tiny.
Say it again.
It must be from your end.
Okay, you know something? Part of my problem is I'm learning how to use headphones and a board, and I'm a late bloomer. So, but it's good for my brain health, I think. Dr. Flowers, I played all of those clips, one from a national protest in 2008 and one from 2009 in the Dirksen, when you went to the meeting. And then the one in Albany. And what I'd like to ask you is, what do you think of how it's going presently in your fight?
Well, I would say that things are not going well. I mean, we're really in crisis situation in this country on a number of levels. And what we're seeing in Washington right now, while they make it appear as if it's suddenly this huge crisis, is something that the White House and Congress have been moving towards for over a year now, really starting when the President created the Deficit Commission back in April of 2010. He put on that commission 14 fiscal hawks, and that was against the desires of many of the people in Congress who were in the Democratic Party. He also, that commission was aligned with an organization called the Pete Peterson Foundation. Pete Peterson provided money to the commission in terms of staff. They also hosted these town halls, these fake town halls called America Speaks. And the Pete Peterson Foundation has been advocating to cut our social insurance programs for several decades now. So we knew that this was all pointing in a position into the direction of what they're doing, which is creating this fiscal crisis. And, you know, I could go into that in more detail, but basically Congress had the right to raise the debt ceiling, and it was a vote in January of this year that made it so they could not do that. But, you know, the instead of raising revenue, which is the obvious solution and something that we can do because we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world, they're using this as an opportunity to cut our social programs. And that's the agenda, and that's probably what we're going to see coming out of Washington.
Well, I'm so sorry we're getting some interference, and I think it just went off a little bit, so thank goodness. How would you move forward?
Well, I think what we're seeing is something that, you know, what's playing out is something we see over and over again when on every issue. If it comes to the financial crisis, the foreclosure crisis, what's going on with education, what's going on with jobs, we have solutions to all of these crises. Same thing with health care. I testified before the Deficit Commission last summer and outlined all the reasons why if we could fix our health care, we would have no deficit. We'd also have better health care for everybody. But it's not the policy that is being listened to at this point. It's the corporate interests that are controlling our political process. And although we have the solutions on every issue, those solutions are not being heard because they don't support the what we have in this country, which is the increasing wealth going up to the top 1% and the mega corporations. And so really, at this point, it's going to take the people joining together in a broad-based justice, peace and justice movement to go to Washington and to their local capitals to demand a different change. And that's where the work that I'm doing right now is going. That's something called the October 2011 movement. It's October2011.org. And this came out of my work for single payer because people would say, how do we change what's happening? Well, we don't have enough people in the single payer movement to change this. And the climate people don't have enough in their movement to change this. The anti-war people don't have enough. But together, we do have enough. And so it's a very exciting initiative that's going on.
Well, you also talked about in your last interview in Albany about the ICU, the Independent Clarity and Uncompromising.
Right, and that's what the October 2011 movement is about. So the three things that I learned out of my experiences with trying to push for real health care reform is that we must be independent of political party. When people align themselves with a political party, and we saw this very clearly with health care, as that health care bill got worse and worse, to where it was not, they were throwing women's rights out the door and coverage for immigrants out the door and even the things that the unions were asking for. People still supported that bill, even though they didn't agree with what was in it, because it became a referendum on the president and whether he would get elected again in 2012, and people felt like if he failed on health care, he wouldn't be reelected. So it wasn't about the policy of what was best. It was all about politics. We don't get anywhere if we align our policy with what a political party is willing to do. We have to align our policy with what we require. And so clarity is important. We have to be educated about what it is that we require and how do we achieve that, because we see so much spin coming out of Congress and from corporate media. And then we have to be uncompromising, because really what we keep doing is accepting what we're given. Even though we know it's not a full solution, we're told that's all that we can get. And none of those partial solutions are moving us closer to where we need to be. So like our counterparts in other nations who, when they don't get what they require, are out in the streets and say that this is not acceptable, we have to stop learning to accept partial solutions and really start demanding the solutions that we require for ourselves, for human life, for ending suffering in this country. And the economic situation that's devastating so many of us.
Yes, I feel very much like you do. But last week I did a tribute to Tommy Douglas. That's how I got to know all about you. Mm-hmm. And one of my ideas, see, I believe it has to be in the small rural communities. That's where the clarity and the education really has to begin. So I had an idea. Why don't people who support single-payer system, universal health care, put a nice big sign in their front windows in their houses saying, I want single-payer. And then why couldn't we have small, throughout the United States, several small clinics, part-time clinics, where those physicians who do want it could maybe give part-time hours towards that until people start to generate towards those clinics. What do you think?
Those are all interesting ideas, and we do have people who put signs in their windows already, saying that they support single-payer or improved Medicare for All. There is a national organization, which is a sister organization to Physicians for National Health Program, and that is Healthcare Now. It's healthcare-now.org, and they have groups that are affiliated with them in almost all of the states, and people that are in those groups are willing to go out and speak at all kinds of community meetings, and they also organize educational fora from time to time, and so that's something that people can go to healthcare-now.org and get involved, find out their local contacts, try to educate people in their community about this. The part about the physicians, there are a number of physicians who are doing this type of work already, and you probably realize that most of the physicians in Physicians for National Health Program are the kind of doctors who do this type of work. But we're in a real crisis with our primary care physicians in this country. It's why I left practice It's very difficult to provide quality care in this country and keep your practice open because the current situation pushes you to see more and more patients and spend less time with them. And that's what you have to do if you want to be able to bring in the revenue to keep your doors open, to pay your nurses and your front office staff. So under that kind of crisis situation already where primary care doctors are really barely, you know, making it, it's hard to ask them to continue to do more, to take on more care that they, you know, don't get reimbursed for.
Well, I think too many people, quite frankly, don't know. I mentioned to some people, you know, I'm going to have single payer, and they said, well, what's that? And I myself kind of knew what it was, but I really didn't know all of the statistics, and I never heard of you, actually, and didn't, know about your arrest at the time. So I have a show, and I would love to spread that clarity within, you know, upstate New York and beyond. And I hope that I can be of help. This station is WGXC.org, so I hope you'll go on and maybe email me and tell me what you think.
Great. Yeah, using the radio to explain, you know, what single payer is and your local groups. And in New York, just based out of Albany, is an excellent group called Single Payer Now. And they organize events where they have hundreds of people that come to those. And not sure if that's something that you can go to. They're trying to organize in all of the counties around New York. So if someone's interested in getting a group started in their county, you can go to Single Payer New York. I think their website is singlepayernewyork.org. But if you Google it, you'll be able to find it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know I have a young man here, Devin, and I'm sure, Devin, you, if you find some of those sites, you'll email them to me, and I can get them onto the radio or something, make announcements for it, right?
Yeah, I know some of the groups that you're talking about. I cut my teeth starting during the healthcare debate, and I heard from all these different groups like Healthcare Now and all those guys that were organizing and being active at that time to support, well, the public option at the time. But so I know generally what you're talking about, yeah.
So here you go.
Healthcare Now is different from Healthcare for America Now. Healthcare Now has been around since 2003, and Healthcare for America Now was organized in 2008 to support the president's legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare Now has always advocated for single payer. Healthcare for America Now, I think they chose that name, which we see frequently. Groups do so that it confuses people and they think that the new group is the old group. And so Healthcare for America Now really is very closely tied to the president's agenda, which unfortunately was not.
You see, there's a little clarity there too. So we'll hope that we can continue this clarity. And I want to thank you so much. I don't know that much about all this technology, so I may have screwed up a little bit, but I certainly hope this comes out fine, and I am so grateful and appreciative that you were so accessible. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good night.
Okay. We did it. Hank, Devin, we did it.
Yep.
We actually, it was kind of that, I don't know where that sound came through, and, right, it was like a, I don't know how
yeah,
that,
I don't
why
know
that
exactly
happened.
What happened.
Yeah. So, but I hope you all heard Dr. Flowers. She's really quite a lady, and I'm going to follow her more often and hope that we can pass on some of the information, because she does bring clarity to it, and it's quite it's quite refreshing to have all of that information. So right now, I'm going to do what I usually do. I'm going to let you listen. Oops. Uh-oh. Thank you. Okay, folks, that was Petey the Beagle, and he was singing to Bad to the Bone, and he was telling us that it's now Animal Connection time. And I want to read you a couple of things, since this is about healthcare for animals. Best Friends, my favorite organization's magazine, in the May-June 2011 issue, has a story on inspiring people, and it's about healthcare for the animals. Laurie Pasternak was working as an associate veterinarian in a private practice when she realized she needed a change. Too often her clients were telling her they couldn't afford a life-saving procedure or surgery. Pets and their people were suffering, and Laurie couldn't bear it. I don't want anyone to be in the position of having to choose between feeding their kids or treating their dogs, she says. So in February 2010, with the support of their husbands, Laurie on the and her business partner Jackie Marasco opened Helping Hands Veterinary Surgical and Dental Care in Richmond, Virginia. By limiting what they provide to include only surgeries and dental procedures, and by cutting out office visits and consultations, they can offer fixed prices that are lower than those quoted by full-service veterinary hospitals. You know, maybe we could pass this idea on to people. In just over a year, Helping Hands has provided care for more than 3,000 pets and has turned a modest profit. We knew it would be good, but not this good, Lori says, amazed by the public interest and community support. Helping Hands has received countless donations from people who believe in their mission and has been overwhelmed with volunteers wanting to help at the clinic. Last November, Helping Hands caught the eye of ABC's Good Morning America and was featured in a segment called Work With Me. Even before the national exposure, strong word of mouth was attracting clients from Canada to South Carolina. On a daily basis, Helping Hands treats animals who live 2 or 3 hours away, usually coming on a referral from their primary vet. When their pet surgery is deemed life-saving, clients who can't pay the entire amount can perform an hour of volunteer work for every $10 of their bill, either at Helping Hands or with an animal organization in their own community. Lori is skilled at removing lumps, bumps, and tumors, and often does so when other veterinarians won't. Take the case of the 12-year-old dog with the 14-pound tumor. He was scheduled for euthanasia when his person found out about Helping Hands. Lori successfully removed the tumor, and the dog lived another 6 months. They were told it couldn't be done, Jackie says. We hear every day, thank you so much for helping. And that's, I think, a beautiful story. And maybe we could use it. Maybe we could do that in our own healthcare system, do you think, Devin? Maybe that'll... Somebody will come up with an idea and we'll do community work if we can't afford the whole operation of some kind. Who knows?
Maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, I would also love to, let's see, on the list is the, I have it right in front. It's the, let's see, I did have it in front. Hold on a second. It's the bonfire. This is about elephants. I happen to love elephants. And I hate that they shoot and kill those elephants for the ivory. But there's a bonfire in Kenya, spotlights shameful, illegal ivory trade. And this is from Born Free. And this was on July 21st. A few decades ago, there were 1.3 million elephants in Africa. The bloody, corrupt, and merciless ivory trade that precipitated the killing of 600,000 African elephants during the 1970s and 1980s is sadly booming across Africa again. Reports of elephant poaching, possibly 35,000 animals a year, and ivory seizures are becoming an almost daily occurrence. Something dramatic needs to be done to protect these magnificent, increasingly imperiled animals, to remind the world to say no, to scream no bloody ivory. Yesterday, a dramatic message was indeed sent. President Mwai Kibaki of Kenya set ablaze 335 elephant tusks, the sad remains of hundreds of elephants, at a ceremony in Tsavo National Park. Born Free staff were at the burn site to witness firsthand this noteworthy event. By torching the 5 metric tons, 11,000 pounds of ivory, whose contemporary illegal street value is an estimated $7.5 million, the Lusaka Agreement Task Force and the government of Kenya made one thing quite clear. The ongoing elephant genocide requires immediate action, or one of the world's iconic animals could someday disappear permanently from many African countries. And I don't know about you. I really think that would be an awful, awful thing if that happened to our elephants. So from on my end of the stick, I have to tell you, I do not appreciate the elephants, that happening to the elephants. Now, I did just briefly tell you, because I don't have it in front of me, and that's annoying me again, but globally, there are a couple of wonderful things that go on, and I'm just going to briefly say it because I don't have it in front of me, except that Italy now has a pets now part of the family health plan. So they are also in Italy allowing their pets to be part of insurance policies. So I think that's a darn good thing. So they're taking all over the world, they're showing more compassion than we are in the United States. So let me see, I have a poem that I so want to read to you. It is called The Outside Dog, and this is it. I wish someone would tell me what it is that I've done wrong, why I have to stay chained up and left alone so long. They seemed so glad to have me when I came here as a pup. There were so many things we'd do while I was growing up. They couldn't wait to train me as a companion and a friend, and told me how they'd never fear being left alone again. The children said they'd feed me and brush me every day. They'd play with me and walk me if only I could stay. But now the family hasn't time. They often say I shed. They do not want me in the house, not even to be fed. The children never walk me. They always say, not now. I wish that I could please them. Won't someone tell me how? All I had, you see, was love. I wish they would explain why they said they wanted me, then left me on a chain. That was written by Anonymous, and it tells a story about how many people, how they treat their animals when they're too busy taking care of them. I don't know, Devin, do you have a lot of animals that are neglected in your community?
My community, not really. They're generally house animals.
So most of them, do you have many strays that you see?
No, not really.
So, and you're in what town?
I'm in Valencia.
In Valencia?
Mm-hmm.
So they more or less take care of their animals
pretty much
so that you don't have too many.
Yeah, there's certain rules around town that you have to have them either on your property, you know, kept there to yourself, or you can't really have them be stray.
Yes, well,
in
my town in Cairo, it's a little different. We do have a problem with dogs getting loose from their homes and people not really looking for them, and it's rather sad because you almost see the dog looking sad itself.
Yeah, we don't see very much of that back where I'm at. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hate that because they could get hit by cars, and you know, who knows what else would happen. But then there is another very famous poem written by Walt Whitman, which I'll end with, self-contained. And he says, I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them, and long, They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with the mania of things. Not one kneels to another, not to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable and unhappy over the whole earth. And that's called Self-Contained, and it was written by Walt Whitman. So, the other thing I wanted to say is the other night I was out and I asked someone, I have a phrase that I like to end my show with, and it's called, life is bearable when. And this woman came up with one. She looked at me and she says, I have one. And it's, life is bearable when the doctor calls and it's benign. And then there is the fortune cookie wisdom, which says, smiling often can make you look and feel younger. So, folks, I hope you learned a little bit about single-payer system tonight. And I hope that you'll remember, it really would be great if you would email and give some feedback and tell me if you think you like what you've learned, or what it is you don't like, what maybe you have some advice for me. Maybe you want me to go and start knitting. But in any event, if you would remember, it's Atrevida, Atrevida 45 at Verizon.net. It's feedback at WGXC.org. It's info at WGXC.org. And before I end, I would like to repeat some of those internet sites that you can go to find more about it. And you remember, if you don't have the internet, you can call, probably if you even gave Dr. Flowers a call, her organization, she would probably be very glad to send you information, or she would give you addresses where you could find information, and that would be 312-782-6006. So you should learn more about this. This is really important for all of us and for Devin's future and even for my future. And these links are www.singlepayeralliance.org, that's A-L-L-I-A-N-C-E, and www.pnhp.org and www.healthcarenow.com. And there's also mdsinglepayer.org, and I think there's one in Dr. Flowers, so we can hear what she has to say presently.